Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today, I am joined by author Bette Williams. I have been trying to get Bette on the podcast for a couple years now, and I was so over the moon thrilled when she finally acquiesced and agreed to come on the show to talk about her book, The Wild Kindness, the psychedelic community, being the token quote unquote queer in said psychedelic community, her experiences in being a Native American activist, her awakening to the Sham Show, all the fun things. I have been a fan of Bette's writing since her first book, Girl Walking Backwards, came out back in the 90s. So it was a super literary fangirl thrill for me to get to drop in with her on today's podcast. Before we dive in, I am reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment. If you're watching with your eyes over on Odyssey, give that channel a subscribe as well. Also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It is the best way to ensure that we can stay in touch. And as we are talking about writing books and the literary path, I am nudging you towards my own offerings, The Language of Betterarchy, Pop Propaganda, Word Up, Little Languaging Hacks for Big Change, and yes, I am, a transformational coloring book, all are on sale through my website, all the places that books are sold. Also wanted a quick caveat that we mentioned the death of Tom Robbins because we recorded this podcast on February 10th, which is the day after Tom Robbins passed. And it was perfect that I got to drop in with one of my own literary heroes to also celebrate and be in the energy of the passing of another one of my favorite literary heroes. So just wanted to give us that little timing explanation. All right, that does it for housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with Bette Williams. Hey.
Yo, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm like on my writing retreat and in a kind of state.
What's yeah. the state? Is it flowing?
It's like, When I have to get in language mode, it's very painful for me. Like, I'm here in these beautiful, incredible settings, as you can see. And when I'm in language mode, I feel kind of disconnected from everything. I was talking to the man of the land, who's a really great art guy and from who has a deep Austin connection, and we were really relating to like what it takes to actually sit down to the page, and it's really painful. It sort of takes one away from the body and all of that. So I might be good with words, but it's also like, oh my goodness, it's very painful to like be so in that place of translating things to language. And I've been here a lot. It's the place I go to when I write, and it's hard.
Yeah. It's so hard. I can totally relate. Whenever I have a new project coming through that wants to be written, a part of me is like, fuck, that means I'm going to become obsessive and dissociated, yeah. and it's going to take me over. And then yeah. every day is the terror of dealing with it. It's weird that it's so scary.
It is. It's like, you know, and then, you know, responses I get from people when I'm like blathering on either social media or with people, they're like, just go outside. And I'm just like, that's not gonna work. Like it just isn't.
No. Are you working on a new book? What are you working on there?
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep working, you know? And I do see what's coming through as being possible with a book, and I hope so.
That's awesome that you're yeah. doing it, that you're there, and that you're being brave.
Yeah, it's just time. I take years off in between stuff to like get in my body and live my life and all of that. Like a lot of writers write every day and they're deeply involved, and I cannot do that. There's definitely a kind of translation to when I work with language that is a kind of a painful separation from my connection with my body. with my connection with nature and all of that. And the guy on the land here, he's just like, yeah, I'm same way, you know, and I spend most of my time clearing. I'm on a Texas ranch right now. And the guy is like, you know, I go and I clear brush and I work with Amanita mushrooms. I work with San Pedro and peyote and my work has to do with providing space for other artists to work. And it's very beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm super excited that we're doing this. Obviously I've been wanting to do this for years and I'm especially excited since Tom Robbins passed yesterday. So
yeah.
It just feels extra special that I get to be with a writer.
Yeah, I know. So many feelings. Talk about a wavelength.
For sure.
Yeah.
So there are like 5 trillion things I want to talk to you about today, but I want to know like what feels most exciting for you. There's what happened with Wild Kindness and how that kind of got subverted. Yeah. There's that amazing article you sent me about Obama and Axelrod, which was completely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
There's, you know, your experience with the whole Native American activist movement.
Yes.
Where do you want to go today?
Let's see. I think I'll ground it with just what I've been working on today, which ties in with the Obama article I sent you, which is I'm working on an essay that Tom is very Tom Robbins inspired. I had a conversation with my friend Beth and I was like, I think I'm channeling him. This was before I knew that he had passed. I was like, this is a Tom Robbins thing. And the essay is, I heard about a remote viewer. It was on Twitter. And she was like, I'm going to the Vatican and I want to see what happened at the Vatican. And so she went to the Vatican. And she was like, okay, there's water under the Vatican and there's a mermaid in chains in a cage in the water. And I was like, that feels true. And so I'm writing an essay and I was like, okay, what is this going to be about? And so I've been writing an essay about Project Mermaid and how during the Obama administration, they linked in with the mermaid in the cage and they sent a bunch of mermaids specifically to the LGBT community to like wrangle them into Obama's project of like creating like more homophobia, more transphobia by attacking the LGBT community with satanic mermaids.
Because I love this.
Did you know that satanic mermaids are a thing in many cultures? Like recently I've been watching videos from Nigerian American evangelicals who believe that mermaids are from Satan's underwater kingdom and that they are, you know, what in our culture we call narcissists.
Okay. And
so, you're right. And so I was like, this is really a funny supernatural thing because I actually feel the energetic of this. And anyway, so the LGBT community was attacked by mermaids from Satan's underwater kingdom in order to disrupt and stir up more conflict in order to wrangle in energetics to feed the empire.
I love it. I totally believe it. I mean, I've seen so many like really sharp on point voices be targeted the past few years and they'll honeypot. So they'll honeypot with a human, they'll honeypot with a satanic mermaid, like whatever it takes.
Exactly.
Just take us off our game.
Yeah, totally. So that creativity, you know, in terms of my deep dives into like occult stuff and all of that, I'm just working with it all. And I said to you when I saw you before, like, I am probably one of the biggest examples of an extremely vulnerable person to every single PSYOP on the map. And I just have to say for your audience that like, I hope you don't take this as an offense, but like, I'm a person who literally like ran away from you in rooms back before 2020 because you wrote an article that was talking about a health based like operation in Santa Fe And you were commenting that everyone was kind of fat and stuff. And like my entire community in Santa Fe was like, you cannot talk to Danny Katz. Like, do not talk to Danny Katz or you cannot, you're going to be fucked.
I don't even remember the article.
Yeah, like why spool?
Oh, you know what? I got so much shit for that article, which I didn't understand because I had no ill intention. Like, I described the man in the leotard and I got all this anger and I was like, I don't get it. Like, I liked Wiseful. Like, I had
That's
a good...
insane.
It was super weird how many people turned on me. And that was so long ago. That was like 2011, 2012.
Exactly.
I didn't get it.
That's how co-opted and psyoped I was by like, all the people in my community are like, this is what you have to think. And I have to give acknowledgement to Ashley Stinnett, who in the beginning of COVID was like, I think I posted something online. I was like, we have to stop this conspiracy theory. Like, I have been, it's really, I'm in a state because right now I'm having like what I would call my like Kanye West breakdown online, minus the Nazi part, minus the racism.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like I just owe this to the community who has stepped so much more far forward than me at a time when it was, I mean, I could cry. My whole energy body's just kind of freaking. So you have a live one here today.
I love it.
Yeah. And Ashley Stinnett was like, the concept was created during, you know, like the Kennedy the situation where it was meant to say like you shouldn't inquire with anything, and it just flipped me. And because of her and because of you and because of a frontline's medical doctor during COVID, you know, saved me from getting vaccinated. And once that happens, I mean, there's an energetic thing that just changes the whole way you look at life. I mean, it did for me. And I'd always been interested in just reading the stuff you're not supposed to read. Like, what the heck is that? So I just kept reading and it's become part of like a culture I really love, from, you know, you and subliminal jihad, power mapping and higher side chats. And it's like, this is like a legitimate cultural like form and that I really love. And it's, it's become a kind of grounding. It's like, you don't find it in a lot of the books coming out. And yeah, just some basic things. Like, I think about one of the concepts of even in nature of insects, when they have an enemy, they actually can make the colors of another enemy and they mirror it and they take the form of that enemy in order to figure it out. Like, think of that in terms of political strategy, you know, and these are things that all kinds of writers have done, from Hunter Thompson, even Timothy Leary, Tom Robbins, of course, like, you know, the what fiction and what shape-shifting and what taking the form of, because everything's politics now, right?
Right.
So taking the form as a kind of medicine, and the idea that culture is, in essence, the word itself is a fungal thing, is meant to be a kind of a natural thing. And then you add in government influence on the likes that has been revealed through the U.S. even just the USAID reveals, you know, it's like, it's astounding to see how nobody really cares that this is happening. But for an artist and writer like myself, it's kind of a big revelation. So that it does a wide swath, but
yeah. Well, I just want to acknowledge the part about you making the very personal choice to not get vaccinated, because I remember talking to Beth when she made that choice, like during hard lockdown, and how all of a sudden it put her in this weird out group that she wasn't expecting. And I think a lot of people who made that choice all of a sudden became pariahs when they weren't
yes.
you know, necessarily like me railing against the machine. They were like these unwitting pariahs. And then it puts, you know, I would imagine like people who made that choice just in a weird kind of nether region of like, wait a minute, I'm not trying to stir the shit up. I just made a choice for myself.
Yeah. And to be acknowledged with you of like, you were an actual pariah. Like,
yes.
Yeah. Actual. And every time I see you, you look relatively sane. I mean, not even relatively, but actually sane, very healthy and bright eyed. Like, how did you deal with that with like your mental health?
Honestly, it was bad. Like, it was really, yeah. really traumatizing. And I just started to get more and more distorted and messed up. And it was our friend, the mushroom. I did one 10 gram journey, which set me up for a 7 gram journey. And it was really that 7 gram that was like, it turned out to be 8 hours that allowed me to transmute wow. the trauma in my nervous system, like on yeah. a somatic level.
Yeah.
And then it's been, I mean, I'm still kind of unraveling that a year and a half later, but I think honestly, like that's, the mushrooms are what saved me. I mean, allowed yeah. me to like re-engage society without being totally terrified 24/7.
Yeah. How beautiful. Yeah. That begs the question of like, whether the fungus of a mushroom, can bring somebody to a real truth, which I don't think it always does, as we've seen with the psychedelic movement.
For because sure.
My experience with the psychedelic movement has been people who are, you know, standing behind this sacrament and just spouting the same old stuff and trying to fit it into their, you know, already hijacked politics and all of that. So I don't think mushrooms automatically do that to people, you know?
It takes diligence. Like I actually yeah. worked with a psychedelic facilitator and I saw where like my ego was giving me exactly what it wanted in my ceremonies. And it really yeah. wasn't until that 7 gram where I was like, no. And it was so yeah. hard that I kept having to like push deeper and deeper. Yeah. All the like kind of smoke up my ass. I was like, no, like we yeah. really need to get to the core. And it was, I don't think I would, like, yeah. I think it took, you know, 30 years of psychedelic journeying to prepare me for that one journey to like really get to the truth.
Wow. I mean, that kind of brings me back thinking about Tom Robbins, because it's not the substance itself that gives you the truth.
Yeah.
But somehow something that gets in you that gives you the mindset of truth and the way he sneakily managed to deliver that. I wanted to say also that Tom Robbins is like a secret lesbian love, and it means you're like a spiritual lesbian. The fact you love him so much and you have that connection, because I do think like he just spoke to a lot of like lesbians like across the globe. Like I read him so long ago and I hadn't been able to read him again, because I would go to him going like, he's doing what I'm doing, so I need to study what he's doing. And the minute I read his books, I'm like, I can't continue, because I'm gonna steal his prose style. It's gonna get in me in a way, and I know he wants me to have my own voice, and you know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I've read all of his books. And so his first one is the one I read last, yeah. the one where they find Jesus. And yeah. I have like 50 pages left and I won't let myself finish it because I don't want to be done with Tom yeah. Robbins.
Yeah.
So that book remains on my bookshelf unfinished.
Yes.
So that I can still discover more.
Wow. I have to ask you, like, I want to know just a bit about your trajectory with him, like how you met him and all of that.
So I was living in at the bottom of Topanga Canyon in the rodeo grounds right behind the Malibu feed bin, which just burned down. And I was living with all these ragtag weirdo artists, and I was writing for the LA Weekly. And I was obsessed with Tom Robbins, and I just decided I'm gonna start writing to him. And what I used to do, which I kind of still do, is make pervy weird drawings on the envelopes to attract people's attention so that they'll open them.
Yeah.
So they were just like these weird letters with illustrations, and he, you know, started writing back really soon. So we had a really kind of lively, you Wow. know, fun, very consistent pen pal exchange. And my boyfriend, Oli, at the time was super jealous. So he made me write. I remember driving into Malibu to Yeah. the post office, and he's like, "You're leading him on." So I wrote on the back of the envelope, "P.S. I don't want to have sex with you." And that was one of the pieces I posted today.
Yeah.
I wrote back. He's like, "I don't want to have sex with you either."
Yeah. Well, I had that experience. You know, like when you connect with a writer, the writer I connected with way long ago, it must have been like 25 years ago, Michael Ventura, who mm-hmm. started the LA Weekly.
Yep.
And also the Austin Sun. I mean, he started in collaboration with many for the LA Weekly, but a major yeah. force of independent journalism. And it was back when we didn't even have the internet. And I looked him up in the phone book. I was stalking him when I was a teenager, because this is a man who wrote so honestly with such force about, you know, his mother being kind of incestuous. Okay, can you edit out coughing?
I will write down the time code. Yes. Are you okay, babe?
Yeah. All right. First, I got hiccups before this started. Interference. It's really happening right now.
Take your time.
Yeah. Okay, pardon me. All right. So Michael Ventura was this writer who I love so much, and I looked him up in the phone book, and you know, I couldn't find him. I made a bunch of calls to a bunch of people named Michael Ventura. Like, I'm not that guy. You know. And then I think it was like, you know, 15 years later, I met him at a party. And I was like, here he is. And I said to him, "Hi, my name is Bette, and I've written a book." That was the wrestling party at the time. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, really?" And I said, "Would you read it?" And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "Bette Williams, I need you to know something. I don't fuck around about art. I will tell you what I think." Yeah. And so the following morning, he was like, "God damn it. I couldn't sleep all night. I read your book. And Bette Williams, you're a real writer." And we hit the road.
And how was it for you to hear that?
Yeah. It was like, there's something misunderstood in the world of art about how you meet your people.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it's about, you know, status, or they call it in academia, being situated.
Okay.
You know, they try to teach it to students. Like, you need to honor your elders. You need to do this or that. It's not about that. It's something much more of the heart. It's an energetic. It's something real having to do with being on the planet in a body and blood.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we hit the road in his 1968 Chevy Malibu that was given to him by a woman on the streets of Austin at a time when he was down and out. And it hit the million mile mark during a fire that was happening like somewhere in California. And he was really worried that the smoke would get in his air filters. And he marked the million mile mark, and he had a cassette tape already made for the celebration of that with all these like Bruce Springsteen songs. And on that road, he taught me so many things. And he said to me, he said, "I pretty much just read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but what it's going to come down to is that America as a superpower is going to get beat by China. And that, you know, what that means is you can hide money under your mattress all you want, but money's not going to mean anything. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the teaching that I'm working with right now, because I really am feeling his teachings, is that he said, once the unconscious becomes conscious, all the things that we've repressed come up. This makes me think of the Leviathan in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Once those things are now the world that we are living in, that is a kind of end times. It doesn't, you know, for me personally, it doesn't mean it needs to be the end of the world, but it is the end of a world.
Yeah.
And I do believe that we're in that right now, between like AI literally like bleeding out anything you want to know, any like pornography, any sexual fantasy, everything is just like blown up. Everyone wants to live out their every fantasy, and that's just what you do. That is the explosion of the unconscious becoming conscious in the world we're living in. And yeah. And so thinking about that a lot. So bring me back a little bit in terms
you
of...
You were on the road with Michael Ventura. Yeah. And he was telling you what it was going to come down to. And that was when he'd read your book, The Wrestling Party.
Yeah. Yeah, and just the connection of meeting another writer in that way, teaching me something that I'm carrying forward, and he is a person whose work comes from some deep organic place, and we are not in that place right now with what is getting published, what we're seeing. Like I even had to put a million training wheels on The Wrestling Party to get it through the door. And I barely did, you know, like I made Wrestling Party like as woke as possible, and yet still feminist press didn't want to publish it.
In what year was this?
This was, 2020, I guess, when it was floating around waiting to get published. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, or maybe in even 2019, 20, so there's a lot in that book that I had to do in order to just pass certain codes. And I think now of like what that book would be if I, you know, got to be, you know, where I was really at, but, you know, I'm still really grateful. I still think it's a really good book. There are certain corrections I would make now, specifically around Maria Sabina. Mm-hmm. Who is the Mazatec mushroom curandera from Huautla de Jimenez, who I think, like in order to tell the story of who she was, I had to really talk about the moment of colonization when Gordon Wasson came in contact with her.
Yeah.
And
was
I had
that required by the publishers?
No. Okay. Yeah, no, this was before I was questioning why, you know, I felt the need to do this. I was really 100% behind it.
Okay.
At the time. Yeah.
Okay.
To view that moment as like only colonization, that the mushrooms were like stolen in a way, that it was a catastrophe, and her houses were burned down and all of that. And in hindsight, that I realized that really demeans the talent of who she was as an individual. Mm-hmm. Because she was working among many mushroom practitioners that use that method, like many Mazatec people, men, women, were using the same rhythms, were using the same ways of working with the mushrooms. Mm-hmm. But Maria Sabina had a particular way of doing it, and a particular rhythm, and a particular resonance. And I believe that resonance can only be explained as talent. Like it got through in a way that was so beyond, and to reduce her just to a Mazatec mushroom practitioner, and that it, you know, like her reach is so huge. And I think that in psychedelic space, I just feel that she deserves the kind of respect as a kind of a universal spirit, and to view her only as a colonized person whose something was stolen really reduces the fact that she was an exceptional person. She really was, like even if it comes down to just her rhythms, like you think of pop stars, because this is the article I wrote for Double Blind, and I was like, you know, compare her to our greatest singers and our greatest, you know, in like writers, and how rhythm and tonality has so much to do with reach. And that's the communication, you know, and yeah.
So I'm thinking of a couple things. I'm thinking of the rhythm that I learned from Tom Robbins, which is so much a part of how I write, right? And everything that I write, I'm saying it out loud and making sure it has that rhythm and flow. But I'm also thinking of the Jesus psyop and how, you know, you walk into any Catholic church and there's Jesus on the cross on the worst day of his life with a crown of thorns looking miserable. Right. Yeah. Now that's the dominant narrative, like with Marina Sabina, this victim narrative versus like Jesus was a badass. How about we have pictures of him in his full power being amazing? Like, where are those stories?
That is so deep. Yeah. I've been returning a bit to the, I meant to go to church the other day here in Texas because I really enjoy going. I mean, lately I really enjoy going to churches to see kind of what's going on in the place I'm going to. And my car got a flat tire. And
I saw your post, not an ordinary flat tire.
And it makes me remember too, like I was thinking about Bob Dylan's Jesus album and how you had to hide it when I grew up. You had to hide, like people were like, you're listening to Blood on the Tracks, you're not allowed. Like that's the one album. It was like porn. It was like, you can listen to Bob Dylan, but you can't listen to his Jesus album. So I'm kind of into Jesus right now.
I'm super into Jesus right now. I just finished Jesus of the Essenes, and now I'm reading about his grandmother, Anna.
Yeah.
Because I had the same kind of mind control around him. And now I'm like, no, like this guy gets a lot of press. Like he's a pretty iconic figure. I want to learn why. But I'm noticing a little bit of a through line in like these cultural dictates of what we're allowed to listen to, who we're supposed to cancel. Like,
yeah.
What is your relationship with these kind of cultural boundaries?
Well, right now I'm in a kind of fracture because there are so many through lines, specifically with Jesus, because like when I was really little, I just have had a Christian heart. Like I fell in love with an ex-nun who was my teacher in junior high school, who was part of she was part of the Montecito Heart of Mary Covenant.
Okay.
And this covenant in Montecito, Carl Rogers, who was a CIA op, went in to practice consciousness raising with this group of nuns. Okay. And this group of nuns included a lesbian who went on to create a zine called Lesbian Tide. But anyway, so Carl Rogers went into this convent and practiced consciousness raising. And within like months, the whole thing fell apart. Everyone confessed love. And the teacher who became my teacher, you know, just realized she just wanted to live a secular life and have a husband and all of that. Which is so interesting because there was an energetic like exploded by that contact. And that contact like gave me Shakti Pop, basically. Like when she walked in the room, I just immediately was like, I love Jesus. And then I saw Godspell with Peter Frampton and it was like all over. You know, so the energy of Jesus is sort of, you know, I can't get to, it's one place because it's so holy. It's like, I don't want to get too occult about it, because there's no way you can figure out which Jesus you're talking to, like all of that. Like it teaches you, like, if something makes you feel that way in your heart and makes you look at every single leaf on a tree and walk through your life deciding you want to give to other people and you want to live a life of service, and your whole life you just want to walk around in love, like, that's okay by me. I'm not going to question, you know, too much where that comes from.
Yeah.
And I was part of the first Black church that in Amherst, Massachusetts, that was, it's like the church was like the enslaved people, we'll give them this church. And so grew up into this church called Home Hope Community Church, run by a gay man named Carlos Anderson. Mm-hmm. So I was like in the choir for 5 years.
Rad.
Yeah. And this guy would walk, you know, around just being like, you know, I went to the supermarket today and I had $400 in my bank account, and a woman in front of me, you know, she was sitting there with her 5 kids and she couldn't pay her bill at the thing. And Jesus told me to buy her groceries. Yeah. And so I did. And I got home and I got a donation or somebody. He's like, sometimes it doesn't happen and you have to wait. But it was a very, very beautiful, really organic, beautiful church that grew up, you know, with the spirit of Jesus. He would be like, I know all you white people that have come to my church, or, you know, you don't want me to talk about Jesus, you know, because you think like this is all like some other kind of new age spirituality, but this is my man.
Did you find any conflict with your love of Jesus and having a Christian heart and being a lesbian?
You know, no, not at all. Yeah. It was just a knowing, especially with like a gay pastor. And, you know, the more I've relatives that are in the Midwest and are in Christian churches, and there's a huge misunderstanding that there's definitely churches that, like my mother, for instance, she was raised in the Baptist church and she became a staunch atheist, just hateful, hateful. Mm-hmm. Because her experience was she was in the church and she has a major story that from when she was a child, where they made this one woman, they were like, you stand up. And they called her out for being a lesbian and they shamed her in the church. And that stuff is seriously done, like across the board. But, you know, a lot of churches, even in evangelical tradition, you know, have an understanding that we're all human beings and we don't understand what that really means. And yeah, you may have to come in there going like, we're all sinners or whatever, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is your, I mean, there's so many different places, but like, as a, like, rather iconic Gen X lesbian, and then what's happened with like the whole alphabet op?
Yeah.
Can you walk me through your experience of that and what your take is on that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, I want your help on this too, in terms of what you might know about Tavistock, because the whole thing of like, take a marginalized group and may, you know, say like they're oppressed, right?
Yeah.
And in order to get your political point across, you actually need the oppression in order to forward the solution, which isn't about making your life better. It's just about forwarding a particular political ideology that in my world has meant empire and war and things that I'm not signing up for. You're like basically being used. Like, I've had an intuitive sense of that, but I only have really come to realize how blatantly obvious it has been. And it's very complex, you know, but, I have felt that the LGBT community, when they're working, you know, in this kind of operation of like, we're in service of this larger political identity, namely the Democratic Party or whatever, is not on my side. And that's been really painful to operate with. I've always been instinctually working against it. Like, I would get invited to, let's say, the Parlor in Los Angeles, which is a wonderful, like, you know, queer drag queeny bar in LA. And I was invited to do a reading there. And I was like, I'm going to bring my Scottish friend, Barry Graham, and my friend, Larry Foundation, who writes about the homeless. Barry Graham's this, like, a Scottish thug who writes incredible writing. You couldn't have a more marginalized guy in terms of being like broke ass working class boxer, beat up all the time in jail. And it just made sense to me. I'm like, you're talking about like what it means to be left out of things.
Yeah.
And I was just like shunned after that reading. I was like, they were like, the guy at the door, the guy who organized it was like, why did you bring them here? How dare you? And
why was that a problem?
Yeah, because they were not queer. Plus, like, you know, queer is the, like, I'm dealing right now with my work being always, because you're not allowed to say lesbian anymore.
Does that piss you off?
Yeah, it does. It's like, queer is an ideology, not an identity. Period. You know, what is queer? It's not like, it's not an identity. And like, I'm not even into like identity based like operations, but you know, there are times and places where, you know, you're a Black person, you want to tell your Black ass life. And then it's, when it's wrapped up in ideology, it's robbed from you. Your whole like life experience is robbed from you. And so to suddenly be like, oh, the only way I'm going to be published, the only way like people are going to recognize me in this situation is by, you know, a queer ideology situation, which grew up and turned into what, you know, we were talking about with the Obama era use of marginalized communities to serve empire. It's been quite a thing to wake up to, and something that at this point I can't not call out, really, you know, because any friends of mine, whether they be Black or transgender, all of that, like people know what's going on, you know, like not everybody, but I mean, yeah. And that's the question. Like somebody said to me the other day, like, you know, this is just soft power, you know, like in the Cold War, it was called soft power. And it was Beth who said to me, like, soft power can also be called colonization. And these days you know, everyone's so punished for any little thing you say, like, oh, you like Elvis. You're not supposed to like Elvis because he stole Black music. It's like, do you even see the structural situation that we're dealing with? And you want me to not see this? It's really obvious. We're being used, every single one of us. And like, we're all used in different ways. It's not like I'm special because I'm from a marginalized group. But, you know, there's that perspective of how, as a marginalized person, you're used. You know?
Totally. I mean, I feel the same as a Jew, but I don't actually feel marginalized.
Yeah.
But I'm watching Jews being used for this larger op.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I both grew up in Southern California. So for me personally, like, I wasn't really exposed to that much racism, homophobia. That wasn't really part of my experience growing up.
Yeah.
But I know it existed. But as far as like the 2008, like post Obama, or I guess Obama era, you know, giant LGBTQ thing, do you feel like that was an authentic response to like flagrant homophobia?
I didn't experience flagrant homophobia. You know, like I got out of the door and immediately I was groomed by a massively powerful therapist who now has like an organization that takes care of like 5,000 teenagers and is a pedophile. So it, you know, it was like, yeah.
I feel like, and I've made this up in my head because I do, from what I've studied about Tavistock, you know, they want to destroy women. They want to destroy the nuclear family.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, but it's the guy who put the T in LGBTQ, who's the publicist for the whole medical freedom movement.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Right?
Wow.
Emily figured that, I know it's totally mind blowing, but I feel like everything went to shit when they gave the rainbow to the gays, where it was like, hey, here's this meteorological experience.
Yeah.
It's yours. And I feel like that was the divide and conquer gauntlet thrown down.
Well, it was when we were seen as an economic demographic. You know, it was just like, oh, wait a minute. We have this whole demographic to exploit. Like, oh, we hadn't thought about this in terms of advertising. Now we can target all these people and they can feel like accepted and special. Yeah, there was a certain point where going to a Pride march just never felt right anymore. I'm trying to think when that was. I'm bad with dates. Yeah.
Yeah. When you were told not to talk to me, like way back in the day, did you authentically think I was homophobic or I was like a threat to the gay community? Like what was that?
You had broken the rules and you hadn't even yet come out as unvaccinated, which was huge. That's when you became actual pariah.
Right.
And I still avoided you then. You know, and the turnaround, thanks to Ashley and all of it, you know, like it was like that's your why you're such a star is it's like the fact that you of all people would be who I shouldn't talk to is astounding.
Right.
Yeah. It also speaks to your power, you know, it's just like, oh, this person is literally dangerous enough, you know, to say like you cannot interact with her and stuff, you know. And that's how, you know, I went through a relationship with somebody, you know, literally like it was just normal for somebody to come up to me and be like, I can't believe you do sweat lodge, you know, and how dare you, and like have a basically what would amount to an intervention because I'm not Native American.
And what would your response be to that? Because I know you were super active in that community for a really long time.
Yeah. Well, my response would be, you know, if you know the culture, that's not how it goes. And then, you know, you can go down the line of the intention of and the organization of the ceremony and what the sacred pipe means and how it is for all people. But being like a hijacked person, I would be like, oh, well, you know what was hilarious was that the one thing that would get them to accept it and not literally like actively try to get me not to go was when I said that my great grandmother was Native American, which is basically Elizabeth Warren Native American, which is basically like Johnny Depp Native American,
right?
Which is such a messed up thing that right. That would be the thing they would be like, oh, well, she, you know, because, you know, if you have a great grandmother, you technically can get papers in the Cherokee tradition. You know, I could, but I can't find. But I was like, you do know that this does not matter. You do know that I'm not Native American.
Did you notice that kind of policing? Like, do you think that was an Obama thing when that kind of social policing started?
It started way, way earlier, like way earlier, like in at Hampshire College. I have a real reason why race politics are really something that throughout my life has really mattered to me a lot. And maybe it would have happened without my ancestry, maybe not. But my grandmother was a heroin addict who almost died giving herself a coat hanger abortion and met the town's only Black doctor in 1936 in Lubbock, Texas. And he was the only one who would treat her. They were like, we will not treat you, but Joel Prince will. And he was the town's only Black doctor. And they got married and they went riding off in the sunset and got quickly arrested with morphine and guns in the trunk. Long story short, my mother ended up growing up in South Chicago among Black people, and in her psyche and everything is just very like race oriented. Like she understands the torment of being attacked by white people and what that means.
Yeah.
And so I entered into college, like it, you know, imprinted with her understanding. And so I gravitated towards the Black community. I was called in and called out to the college's like Black nationalist group for being too interested in Black women in my school. This was a problem. Yeah, they were like, Bette Williams is like,
white people had a problem.
She's like
with
a
this?
Chaser, or she's like a chaser or something, you know.
I had my own version because I dated a lot of Black guys in college, yeah. Specifically the star basketball player at UCSB. Yeah. And the Black girls would throw pennies at me totally. When they saw me on campus.
Totally. Yeah. And then I've been talking to friends about, you know, like the George Floyd thing and how, you know, you put the Black square up, you put the Black square down, and then some white chick would yell at you if you weren't doing the right thing. And I was looking at all the, you know, I'm trained to find her. I know how, when I see a racist, I know a racist. And all those freaking Instagram white chicks who were calling everybody out, they were the racist. And,
100%.
But yeah, just full on.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. I mean, that's the I mean, I can't say it's the most ridiculous thing of this sham show we're living through, but it's one of them. It's like all the people calling it out are attuned to that perspective because of their unacknowledged racism. Like, they're the racist. It's so crazy.
It's like, don't tell us what we can't see with our own eyes. It's a physiognomy. It's an attitude. It's like a way of being. You're a racist. Like, right. Come on. Yeah.
Did you ever get grief within the Native communities for attending Sweat Lodge?
No. But like the problem with, you know, life in Santa Fe is that it's so deep, like the pain of what has gone on and the pain of what has gone on is so long term that the non-acceptance of white people is so deep. But I do think that the recent permission for that, for like there is something to saying we're in a ceremony that honors all people, but you will not ever be accepted for a few lifetimes, maybe, you know, that kind of thing. But there are different communities that I imagine and I hope are not like that. But my experience has been at a certain point spiritually, it's like I can't place the care of my soul in a place where I'm going to be judged for who I am on that level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did that contribute to you stepping away from your activism in those spaces? That does it for the first half of my conversation with Bette Williams. As you are inspired to tune into the second half, which I highly recommend because we get into some really juicy stuff. You can find that over on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. At both communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content, plus that warm, fuzzy, ooey gooey feeling that comes along with supporting a woman who sometimes makes videos, who sometimes record podcasts, who sometimes writes books, keep on keeping on. And in case it wasn't clear, yes, I'm referring to me. Also reminding you last time to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. And thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you on the locals and the Patreon. Have a rockin' day.